From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! With a million Rwandan refugees in Zaire, should a multinational force intervene? Should the U.S. be a part of it? We'll have a discussion. Also, the criminal justice system in the United States, does it target African-American males? A debate on crime in prisons. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. By the way, I should say that we're going to be changing that slogan, and we urge you all to participate in a little contest we're going to be having. And that is to come up with a new slogan. You know, the exception to the rulers, that'll remain. A political talk show, that'll certainly be there. But what do you think should be the tagline for the new Democracy Now! In this post-election period? Why don't you give us a call at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. It's Democracy Now!'s comment line, and we'll be playing some of your suggestions in the days to come. This is the latest news. The Army is ready to take action in another case of alleged sexual misconduct at a training base, this time at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, according to a Pentagon official. Such a move would take place as early as today against the first of several male soldiers under investigation at the Missouri base. The Army last week filed criminal charges against three military trainers and administrative charges against two more. An additional 15 instructors were placed on paid administrative leave, this at the Maryland Training Center. What a difference a couple of years can make. House Speaker Newt Gingrich says he's ready to work with President Clinton. That's a far cry from the Contract with America days when Gingrich ignored the White House as he pushed the manifesto through Congress. In a speech last night, a more conciliatory Gingrich spoke of cooperation, saying not just America, but the world depends on Republicans in Congress and Clinton working together. Gingrich also told members of GOPAC, the political action committee he once headed, that Republicans should not be depressed over Bob Dole's loss to Clinton. Instead, he suggests the GOP should celebrate keeping control of Congress. There are calls now by people even within his party in Congress that he should step aside as Speaker of the House while the ethics investigations continue. The Baptist College, founded by Reverend Jerry Falwell, avoided another foreclosure threat by paying an overdue $1.1 million to bondholders yesterday. Falwell, founder and chancellor of Liberty University, paid up, but called the threat unreasonable and reckless because it jeopardizes a possible bank loan of $7.5 million. And students in Riverside, California, protested the end of state affirmative action programs, and at least 20 of them were arrested. They forced their chancellor to hold meetings outside when they took over the administration building yesterday. Proposition 209, approved in the November 5th election, ends race and gender as considerations in public hiring, contracting, and college admissions. This news from Guatemala. Rebels and government negotiators have agreed to a permanent ceasefire. The move ends a civil war that has lasted 36 years. But the overwhelming majority of the 140,000 lives lost were attributed largely to military and paramilitary forces. The Sandinista Front yesterday in Nicaragua formally appealed the results of Nicaragua's October 20th elections, won by Arnaldo Alemán of the right-wing Liberal Alliance. The Sandinistas added to weeks of post-electoral bickering by demanding new elections be held in the provinces of Managua and Matagalpa and calling for a revision of the vote at polling stations in 13 provinces due to what it said was evidence of fraud. From the brothels of Asia to the construction sites of Egypt, nearly twice as many children are working full-time in developing countries as previously thought. This according to the International Labor Organization. The latest calculations from the UN Labor Agency show that 250 million 5- to 14-year-olds are employed, half of them full-time, up sharply from earlier estimates of 73 million full-time child workers. And today is the fifth anniversary of the East Timor massacre, which hundreds of Indonesian soldiers gunned down more than 250 Timorese on November 12, 1991. Four men from East Timor sought political asylum in the Spanish embassy in Jakarta last night. As students staged a brief protest on the fifth anniversary of the killings of the Timorese 5 years ago. Meanwhile, in Kuala Lumpur, 20 Malaysian human rights activists remained in jail today, 3 days after an aborted East Timor conference, and families of the detained prepared a candlelight vigil in protest. And you may have heard that President Clinton is going to be headed to the Philippines later this month for the APEC conference. That's the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. Well, Philippine soldiers have just arrested one of the country's top leftist leaders in what his supporters said was a move to neutralize opponents of this month's APEC summit. Philemon Lagman, who heads a workers group that military intelligence reports have accused of plotting to disrupt the November 25th summit, was arrested in a hotel in a Manila suburb earlier today. Also, the Nobel Peace Prize winner of 1996, Jose Ramos Horta, has been barred from going to the APEC summit. You're listening to Democracy Now! The crisis in Central Africa has reached critical juncture. Over 1 million mostly Hutu refugees are struggling to survive in eastern Zaire, where Zairean rebels and the mostly Tutsi Rwandan army are fighting the Zairean military and extremists among the Hutu refugees. Yesterday, the leader of Zaire's Tutsi rebels, who have surrounded Rwandan militants in a camp full of hundreds of thousands of refugees, threatened to attack the camp if an international force does not intervene soon. The United States and the United Nations are faced with the question of whether to intervene and how. We're joined by three people to talk about the situation. Rakia Omar joins us. She's with Africa Rights and is in Kigali, Rwanda right now. She has just returned from Zaire. We'll also be joined, hopefully, by Kathy Austin, director of the Africa Project in Washington, D.C., and she is with the Institute for Policy Studies. Finally, Dr. Horace Campbell joins us. He's professor of African American Studies at Syracuse University and is a former director of the Syracuse University Africa Program based in Southern Africa. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Rakia Omar, let's go to you first in Kigali. Can you give us a description of what is happening in Kigali and on your trip to Zaire?
Well, Kigali is very quiet. It's very far from any area of fighting or of refugee spillover. So actually the only thing you notice in Kigali is that it's been invaded by journalists and human rights people, not so much human rights, but aid workers and diplomats and other people like that. Otherwise, there's no tangible consequences on a daily life in Kigali. As far as my trip to Eastern Zaire was concerned, I was this time mainly in South Kivu, that is in Bukavu, and in Uvira. I have not yet been to Goma. I'm planning to go there later in my trip. But I think the most important comment I need to make on your introduction is that it is very important for the international community to realize that a huge percentage of these people who are constantly referred to as helpless refugees are criminals. They are fugitives from justice who organized the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, who have continued to kill survivors of the genocide in Rwanda, and who are responsible to a very large extent for this disaster today. They went over to Zaire and they decided to exterminate the Zaireans of Tutsi origin from everywhere in that region of the country. So these are not for wholly innocent people who deserve our sympathy. Some of them are innocent refugees who are being held hostage by these very criminal forces. So it's very, very important for your readers, your listeners, to realize this very, very important difference, because these people committed the genocide in Rwanda in 1994 and are responsible for the current disaster facing this region.
Professor Horace Campbell, do you share Rakia Omar's analysis?
Oh, completely. I think this is the point that one has to stress. I think there are two points. One has to deconstruct this idea of Tutsi the Hutu, which is really a colonial construction.
Dr. Campbell, we're going to have to call you right back because we don't have a very good line. It's hard to hear you.
I will speak up. Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, this is better, yes.
Yes. What I'm saying is that there are two points. First, is the question of Hutu and Tutsi, the way in which the media tries to present this tribal image of Africans. And this tribal image is a colonial construction. It's a colonial construction that feeds into the present humanitarian recolonization of Africa. I think the question that Rakia raised is central, that the people who organized and coordinated the genocide in 1994, they still use innocent people as shields to protect them from international justice. And the second point that has to be underlined is the way in which sections of the international community want to use this crisis as a way to shore up the dying Mobutu regime. The Mobutu regime is a regime which is anti-democratic, dictatorial, and is against the interests of the peoples of Zaire. So while people talk about a looming humanitarian crisis in eastern Zaire, there are over 40 million Zaireans who are facing a humanitarian crisis. So the question of democratization and a transition to away from the Cold War reflex of military intervention is something we should be thinking about in this region.
Well, let's talk for a minute about the ruler, the longtime dictator of Zaire, Mobutu Sese Seko, and his relationship to the United States, Dr. Campbell.
Yes. Well, the Mobutu regime, as many of your listeners know, was brought to power after the United States of America, France, and Belgium coordinated the elimination of the nationalist movement in the Congo, and it was then stabilized to become Zaire. Mobutu Sese Seko has been in power for the past 30 years in this country. He has been responsible for the destabilization of most of the countries in this region, and every time there is a challenge to Mobutu's regime in the country, there's intervention by the French, the Moroccans, the United States of America, and I think this will be a good time for the CIA to open up its books about the relationship between Mobutu, the United States, and Central Africa, because many of your listeners know that Mobutu is reputedly one of the richest persons in the world, where the people of Zaire are very poor. And the extremists who coordinated genocide in Rwanda have support from Mobutu. The CIA also ran its war against the peoples of Angola from Zaire. Jonas Savimbi still received military, financial, and political support from the militarists in Zaire. So the government of Zaire has a lot to answer for, and the United States government must go beyond the period of the Cold War, where everything is seen in military terms. If there's a humanitarian crisis in Rwanda, Burundi, and eastern Zaire, one needs to think of how to organize humanitarianism against those elements who want to recolonize Africa under the guise of humanitarian intervention.
Well, let's talk about that intervention. Our newswire says that France has stepped up criticism of the United States for dragging its feet over joining a multinational force to secure urgent relief for starving refugees. The latest blast by French Defense Minister Charles Milon came on the eve of a visit to Paris by U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher, who's expected to face strong pressure to approve a U.N. mandate for an emergency humanitarian operation in Zaire and U.S. participation in the proposed force. What do you think of that, Rakia Omar?
I think if there is military intervention in eastern Zaire, it will make what happened to the American troops in Mogadishu look like child's play. There will be war. First of all, there will be war with the militia and the former soldiers of Rwanda who are fighting to keep the refugee population as human shields and as hostages. And if the aim of the intervention is to feed the innocent refugees, the only way to do that is to separate them physically from the criminals who are surrounding them, who are with them physically, and many of whom, of course, are their sons and their fathers and their cousins and their daughters. These are not two different populations. And therefore, the intervention will have to proceed with the preparedness militarily, politically, and psychologically of serious engagement in war with those elements. And the spillover of that will, I think, inevitably mean a widening of the war in that region. And I cannot see any domestic public in the West accepting that. And I would not advise them to accept that, because to lose human lives in order to engage in battle with people who are guilty of genocide and who should be rounded up and arrested instead of being treated as if they merit our sympathy and our concern, I think is absurd. And the practical reality is that to get to the innocent refugees, the only way to do it is by war. And France has dirty hands in this affair. France has absolutely no interest in helping innocent refugees. It supported the perpetrators of genocide during the genocide and after the genocide. It does not want these people arrested and therefore in a position to talk. It wants to be in a pivotal position in order to oversee and play a critical role in Zaire in the post-Mobutu era. It has its own immediate political interest, and this has nothing to do with French humanitarian concern. That's just a hogwash.
I think
Professor Horace Campbell.
I think this point has to be underlined. I think Rakia's point is right on the target.
Speak as loudly as you can, Dr. Campbell.
This manipulation of public opinion in the West is something that your radio station must try to take the lead in. France has no history of humanitarian intervention in Africa. The role of France in Africa has consistently, since 1960, to support dictators, to support those who exploit the African people, and to roll back any democratic gains in Africa. Rakia said that France wants to go in to ensure there is a post-Mobutu regime that is sympathetic to the exploitation of the Zairean people and the continued destabilization and unrest of Africa. Zaire is central to the future of peace and stability in Africa. Zaire is bordered by Sudan, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, Zambia, Angola, Congo-Brazzaville. The point is that they know the centrality and importance of Zaire, and they will try to do everything to prevent Zairean people intervening in the political process. It is not in anyone's interest that there is an extension of the war. There are efforts by the Organization of African Unity, by African government, to try to intervene in a way in which Rakia has said, so that one separates the perpetrators of the genocide from the real refugees. And the point is, the refugees should go back home to Rwanda. That is the question which is at stake. And France is not interested in that.
In addition to Dr. Horace Campbell of Syracuse University and Rakia Omar of Africa Rights, who's in Kigali, Rwanda right now, we are joined by Kathy Austin, director of the Africa Project of the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington. She returned from the area about 4 weeks ago. We talked about the role of the United States in supporting the Zairean dictator, Mobutu Sese Seko, but what about in Rwanda, Kathy?
Well, the U.S. has played a considerable role in backing the current Rwandan government, and that is something that needs to be thought about in this equation. Actually, 6 months ago, the vice president of Rwanda, Kigame, came to Washington, D.C. and visited U.S. government officials. It was at this time, 6 months ago, when he informed the U.S. government that Rwanda would be invading into Zaire. This information was not released to the humanitarian workers on the ground. It was not shared. There was a lack of transparency in this particular issue. And as a result, you see an escalation of conflict and fighting. And it's given the United States this sense of plausible deniability in having the Rwandan government take care of the camps, breaking up the camps, something that the U.S. did not want to commit its own political will or resources to do in a more voluntary way.
What about the role of the United States and also France in terms of weapons? Who is responsible for the weapons in the area, Kathy?
Well, you've seen in the beginning, there's been an international embargo imposed against the former Rwandan government forces since May of 1994. After the imposition of the embargo, France sent a number of weapon shipments to its former allies that were based in eastern Zaire. There were at least 10 shipments of weapons that I was able to document while I was on the ground. Subsequently, weapons have continued to pour in from countries such as South Africa. Weapons that have remained in the region from the Angola War continue to pour into eastern Zaire. But countries such as Belgium, Italy, and Germany have private arms networks which are operating from their sphere of influence. And nationals from these particular countries are heavily engaged in supplying weapons to the Hutu militias in eastern Zaire. In the case of the current Rwandan government, in the case of the Tutsi militias that now have weapons and that themselves are fighting in eastern Zaire, a lot of the military assistance has come from mainly Western countries. The U.S. is providing extensive training. It has U.S. special forces in the area. Britain is also supporting training in the area. And many of the Western countries are providing arms, but generally the arms are coming through private networks because we're not talking about heavy weapons here. We are talking about small arms. We're talking about landmines and grenades.
What corporations here benefit from this arms trade to Eastern Zaire and Rwanda?
Well, largely what you see is in the post-Cold War era, a lot of the networks that used to be engaged on behalf of governments in covert operations now find themselves no longer in positions where they still have the infrastructure intact, where they know who the weapon suppliers are, they know where the private stocks are, the private channels. There's a lot of weapons flowing around from former conflicts, such as in Angola, former Yugoslavia, Eastern Europe, former Soviet republics, and that's where a lot of the weapons are coming in, but it's Westerners who are involved in the networks.
We're going to come back to this discussion on what is happening in Zaire and Rwanda in just a minute, and then we're going to bring you a debate on crime and prisons in this country. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests, Rakia Omar of African Rights. She is in Kigali, Rwanda right now, has just returned from Zaire. Kathy Austin is with us in the studio. She's director of the Africa Project of the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington, D.C. She's just returned from 3 months of research in Central East and Southern Africa. And we're joined by Dr. Horace Campbell, professor of African American Studies at Syracuse University, former director of the Syracuse Africa Program based in Southern Africa. He's also a member of the Global Pan-African Movement. As also a way of introducing Rakia Omar, I did want to say, people may remember that you were with Human Rights Watch Africa, Africa Watch, until you opposed the U.S. intervention in Somalia. And then you were forced to leave, and you set up your own group in Britain called African Rights. Do you see any parallels here between Somalia and Rwanda and Zaire, Rakia?
Well, yes, I do, particularly with the talk of an intervention. I mean, it certainly brings back those days and of assessing whether that was a sensible move, and we predicted that it would engender a great deal of violence, and that's unfortunately exactly what happened, and I fear that it would be a replica of that again, except it would be on a much larger scale than what happened in Somalia. Again, I see the hyping up of the situation by the relief organizations who are motivated but largely by self-interest and who have contributed to an immense degree in bringing about this disaster. It was the relief organizations, many of them American, others European, who, through disinformation and manipulation of the facts on the ground, naivety and lack of political judgment and lack of political information to base their advertisements and assessments on, predicted then in Somalia that 2 million people were going to die, which was absolutely nonsensical. Now are predicting that 1 million people are going to die, which is again absolutely nonsensical, and they are doing that for a number of reasons. One of them, to camouflage the extent to which they contributed to this disaster, and they did so because it is the United Nations agencies, particularly the High Commission for Refugees and the relief organizations that treated this in 1994, treated the genocide and the consequences of the genocide and the flight of the refugees into Zaire as a humanitarian disaster when it was nothing of the sort. It was a politically motivated exodus and it was always had genocide at the center of this drama, and they fed these criminals. They made it possible for them to hold the refugee population hostage. Then they gave the material assistance that allowed the refugee population to siphon off some of that money and to pay contributions to the militia and to the army, which was then used to buy armaments, which was then used to destabilize the region, to kill the survivors of the genocide. So they have brought about this disaster to a very large extent. They don't want an examination of that situation.
Kathy
so they
Austin,
are again crying that there is a humanitarian disaster.
Kathy Austin, do you agree with us?
Well, I agree that humanitarian assistance is non-neutral, that it comes with all kinds of political and military elements to it. And particularly in the case of Eastern Zaire, both the humanitarian relief community, but also the governments backing these humanitarian relief communities and backing the United Nations, have not done a good evaluation of its own role in creating a lot of the disaster that Rakia is talking about. But I think what we need to be mindful of is that in terms of that refugee population now undergoing a huge humanitarian crisis, over half of that population is children. Over half of that population is women, and the militants and the soldiers are those with weapons who have commandeered vehicles, they've stockpiled the relief supplies, and they're going to be the ones who are going to go off into their hidden military bases in the hills. And meanwhile, there is a very large civilian refugee population which does demand a humanitarian response.
Can I respond to that? I think it's, I agree with Kathy, but I think that it is naive in the situation of Eastern Zaire to say that women and civilians are by definition innocent and have nothing to do with the killers. That is not true. A very large number of women in the refugee camps participated in the genocide, though not obviously to the same extent as the armed military leaders. They have supported the genocidal policies during the genocide, and in these 2 years of exile, they support through their contributions and through their propaganda the policies of these people. So the children clearly are victims for whom these parents and the people are responsible. But I don't think we should reduce all women and all civilians
into
innocent victims in this situation. They are not.
Right. Rakia is correct. There have been women who have both been victims and victimizers in this particular case. But what I think this does illustrate is that, and what has been lacking in this whole equation, is that there needs to be committed resources to screening the refugees so that those are who are considered legitimate refugees will be able to receive the kinds of humanitarian assistance that they deserve, particularly given our international humanitarian law standards, and that those who are perpetrators of the genocide or suspected perpetrators of the genocide can finally be brought to justice.
We started this discussion by talking about the call for an international force. The leader of Zaire's Tutsi rebels, who are surrounding Rwandan Hutu militants in a camp overflowing with hundreds of thousands of refugees, is saying that his forces will attack the camp if an international force does not intervene quickly. Dr. Horace Campbell, there are all different forms of an international force. You could have a multilateral force of African nations. You could have a multinational force that includes countries like France and the United States. What do you think? What is your assessment of what would work here?
Well, the meeting of the...
And again, speak as loudly as you can, please.
The meeting of the leaders of East Africa, meeting in Nairobi last week, called for a neutral force. That is a force that has no commitment to any of the participants in the genocide. I think the accent on military force is problematic. One needs an intervention force to be able to assist the refugees who want to go home and to separate them from the perpetrators of the genocide. I think I want to underline the point that Rakia has been making throughout this discussion, and that this is a political question, a question relating to genocide, and any intervention in Eastern Zaire must bear this in mind. This idea of humanitarianism is a thin veil to disguise forms of recolonization and a new lobby which is more important than the international arms lobby. That is the international humanitarian lobby. That is people who have a vested interest in seeing conflict, seeing warfare, and seeing disaster in Africa. I think one needs a force of doctors, nurses, humanitarian workers going along with a military force that is neutral to separate the refugees from the perpetrators of the genocide. But I think the accent must be on the political question, because it's unthinkable that 2 years after World War II, that the perpetrators of genocide in Nazi Germany could be hiding somewhere in Europe without being brought to justice. But this being tolerated because African lives have been devalued and worth less than other human lives.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us. This is clearly the beginning of an ongoing discussion, as the situation will clearly not dissipate anytime soon. We've been joined by Rakia Omar of African Rights. It's based in London, but she is now in Kigali, Rwanda, just having returned from Zaire, and she is headed to Goma. We've also been joined in our studio here in Washington by Kathy Austin, director of the Africa Project of the Institute for Policy Studies, who has also just returned from 3 months' research in Central, East, and Southern Africa, and Dr. Harris Campbell, who we just heard from, professor of African American Studies at Syracuse University, former director of the Syracuse Africa Program, which was based in Southern Africa, where he has spent a good deal of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us and for enlightening us on the situation in Zaire and Rwanda. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we're going to take a musical break. When we come back, we're going to have a debate on crime and punishment in the United States. You are listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily political talk show. I'm Amy Goodman. The war on drugs has created an explosion in the American prison population, with the number of prison inmates now threatening to exceed the number of students attending college. And those winding up in the nation's criminal justice system are disproportionately young, Black, and male. Amid all the get-tough-on-crime rhetoric of the election season, there was little talk of the real social and economic costs of our nation's crime policies. Well, today we're going to talk about those policies. We're joined by Jerome Miller. He's author of a book called Search and Destroy: African-American Males in the Criminal Justice System. And he's director of the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives, based here in Washington, D.C. We're also joined by Paul Kaminar. He's legal director of the Washington Legal Foundation, here also in the nation's capital. It's a conservative think tank. And we're joined from New York by Daryl King. He's executive director of the Community Justice Center in Harlem, New York. He spent more than two decades in New York's prison system. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Well, let's start with Jerome Miller. How do you lay out the problem of crime and prisons in this country?
Well, I think I really lay it out in a wider term than criminal justice. I think we've made a decision in this country, I think it's a wrong decision, to deal with a wide variety of social, economic, employment, personal, family problems by relying on the criminal justice system. And the criminal justice system ultimately is a hostile procedure that alienates people. And I think what we're seeing now is the effects of that. I think if we get harsh enough, we can lower crime, but in the long run, it'll come back to haunt us. And I think that's where we're headed now. I think some criminologists are predicting that shortly after the turn of the century, certainly before 2010, we will have on any given day the absolute majority of young African American males, that is those between 18 and 40, in prisons or camps. And I don't think that's at all an alarmist view. I think we're headed very definitely that way. For the first time really in our history, perhaps since slave days, the average young African-American male can expect to at least be arrested, at least handcuffed, perhaps shackled, certainly given a mugshot and a criminal record, and brought into the criminal justice system. About 75% will be arrested and given a criminal record now before they complete their 35th year. As you know, on any given day now, and we did a study here in D.C., 42% of African-American males in 1991 were under criminal justice supervision, that is, in jail, in prison, on probation, parole, being sought on warrants or out on bond.
42%.
42%. And the figure in Baltimore is 56%. Now, this is a sea change, because if you look back to the 1920s and 30s, although African-American males were always overrepresented, I think much because of economic issues, perhaps about 20% of them coming into prison were African-American males of those new admissions to state and federal prisons. It's now approaching 55%. And then if you factor in Hispanic Latinos, it puts us near 75%. And I think this is really a sea change that has redefined the whole debate, because I think in the average white person's mind now, when we talk about crime, we see a black or a brown face. And I think it gives leave now for policymakers to be as vicious as they wish to talk crime, really mean race, but it's never mentioned.
You know, I should say that Jerome Miller, in addition to having written this book called Search and Destroy, does speak from the inside, as he was the administrator of the Massachusetts juvenile detention system. Paul Kaminar, are you alarmed by these figures?
Yes, I am. I'm alarmed by them. And the what we are finding out, though, is that the incarceration rate, though, is having some deterrent effect. If you look in California, for example, with the three strikes and you're out law in the last couple of years, they are experiencing an all-time drop in their crime rate on major crimes, with homicide, with rape, robbery, armed robbery, child abduction, and so forth. So you're seeing that the high incarceration rate is having a deterrent effect, and that's a good thing for law-abiding America. One way to keep out of prison, very simply, is don't commit the crime. I mean, it's alarming in the sense that we have a lot of crime in America, but we're seeing that there is deterrent effect by having the high incarceration rate. During the campaign, President Clinton was extolling the fact that crime is dropping across America, and he's right. And the reason that's happening is because we are telling the criminal element, look, no more revolving door of justice here, where you come in, get on probation, do a couple months, and you're back out on the street again. You're going to serve substantial periods of prison terms.
But doesn't it suggest that there's something wrong with the American criminal justice system, that you have so many African Americans and Latinos in jail, such a disproportionate number?
I don't think that has to do with the criminal justice system. A RAND Corporation study, for example, recently concluded that there's no discernible or documented racism or bias in the criminal justice system, if that's what the question is implying. You have a lot of minorities in the system, to be sure, but you have to look at the percentage of those who commit the crime. In other words, you look at you compare apples with apples, and although blacks, for example, are you know 15 to 20% in the population, the general population, that doesn't mean that you should find 15 or 20% in the prison population. You look at what percentage of minorities actually commit crimes, and they find out that the incarceration rate is roughly the same of the percentage of those who commit crimes. So that's not a surprising statistic.
Daryl King, do you think that the presence, that stricter and stricter enforcement is leading to a decrease in crime and that that's a good thing, you with your perspective from the inside of prison walls?
No, I really think that that's a joke. You know, we never talk about the issues of, you know, how did crime develop in the African-American and Hispanic community? We do not manufacture drugs. We do not manufacture weapons. We do not manufacture bullets that go into the weapons. We do not manufacture fences that are going in, that goes into our community, that take stolen gold. I mean, there's all these issues that are really not even addressed. We don't even talk about stiffer penalties for people who transport drugs from out of the country into our country. You know, I happened to be in the feds for 2 years appealing my case, and a guy got busted with a truckload of cocaine and got 3 years. But in New York, you get busted with an ounce and you get life in prison. So where is that fair? And what happens to the people who get into prison and develop themselves and understand that they made a bad decision and now can contribute back to society, and you don't want them out?
We're going to have to take a break, but when we come back, I wanted to talk about your own experience, Daryl King, in prison with the various programs that are there now, programs actually that are no longer there, that you were able to take advantage of and what that meant in your life. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're speaking with Jerome Miller, author of Search and Destroy, African-American Males in the Criminal Justice System, Paul Kaminar, who's with the Washington Legal Foundation, and Daryl King, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Center in Harlem, New York. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest, Jerome Miller, author of Search and Destroy and director of the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives, Paul Kaminar, legal director of the Washington Legal Foundation, and Daryl King, executive director of the Community Justice Center in Harlem, New York. Daryl, can you give us a picture of what happened to you more than two decades ago, the state you went into prison, and what happened to you while you were there?
Well, when I was in prison, there was very few programs. In 1971, the Attica riot was they had the Attica riot, and they developed programs in the prison system, which we took advantage of. I couldn't read or write. I came out of the United States Armed Forces, honorable discharge, and I had a reading and a writing disability. So, and behind being wrongfully convicted, I tried to learn how to read and write, trying to free myself. And through going through the programs in prison, I wound up getting an associate degree, my GED, an associate degree, and now a bachelor's degree. And there's a lot of guys who are in, black guys and girls in prison, who are dropouts from the school systems and who have bachelor's degrees and master's degrees and were soon come Lord, 4.0 got a 4.0 average. And you got to ask yourself, well, how does that happen? You know, and then we always talk about the one case of a person who's out on the street on parole that does something wrong, but we never talk about the success stories of the many prisoners who've gotten out, who went through parole supervision and are successful law-abiding citizens in the United States.
We should also say, Daryl, that you became head of the NAACP in jail. You became head of the JCs, the
yes.
junior JCs, and what else?
I was also the commander of American Legion, and I headed the Sincerely Disabled Unit. I worked for Fire and Safety, creating programs to protect the inmates as well as staff for evacuations. And, you know, and
yet
yes.
the program that you were a part of that enabled you to eventually get your GED and then ultimately your bachelor's degree no longer exists in prison.
Right. These programs have been abolished in the prison program in prison, and now that there's no college program in prison, so now a person who gets his GED, that's the end of his life. And what I'm saying to you, what do you want? I mean, for $30,000 a year or whatever the cost it is to keep, you should want some return for that investment, like any other investment.
You mean the $30,000 a year it takes to keep someone in prison for a year?
Yes.
Well, there is a return.
Paul Kaminar.
Yes. Studies have shown that while it may cost $30,000 a year or so to incarcerate a person a year, that the savings to society by not having crime take place ranges from 3-1 to 17-1 ratio. The average robber, et cetera, has committed 40 to 60 to 100 crimes that they weren't caught on. These are hard statistics. So that they have shown that the society is saving a ton of money by having a violent criminals locked up.
But what about those white-collar criminals who steal millions of dollars, who not only steal millions of dollars, that they get smacked on their wrist and they go back into society and they're okay?
Well, you're speaking in generalities. You have cases of...
Well, you're
cases
speaking
of,
in generalities,
no,
too.
No, I'm not. I mean, I think Ivan Boesky was a white-collar criminal. I think he did 3 years in prison. They should be in prison as well. But you have to look at what the cost. What the penalties are provided by.
3 years, right? 3 years. What about the government crimes?
Yeah, there's a lot of assaults out there where people are raped and robbed and assaulted that they serve that they're on parole probation from the get-go. They don't serve any time.
Paul Kaminar, let me ask you something, and it's about these education programs in prison that have been eradicated. Do you think it's a good thing that Daryl King was able to go from not being able to read and write to having a bachelor's degree and that he did that in prison?
Well, I think that's terrific. My hat's off to him. But I'm not sure that the situation is such that there's no education programs whatsoever in any prison in the United States, both federal and state. I think he's probably speaking from his particular experience
in
up
New
there.
York State.
No, I'm talking about in New York
yeah.
State. They did away with the college. Well, no, in all prisons that get federally funded for college, there's no more
for the college.
Funds available
college. I don't have the information on that. Whether that's a nationwide.
Well, it was a bill that was passed by Congress.
Yeah. Well, I think there should be work programs in prison. There's the. A Unicorp program in the federal prison where they learn a skill and a trade and things like that. I think they should be doing something there in prison rather than watching color TV and lift weights and so forth. So I think we need to make a use of their time while they're in prison.
Jerome Miller, that is a standard argument when talking about prisons. A standard picture we have, if people haven't been in prison, is the idea of barbells and cable TV.
Well, prisons, for the most part, are human sewers. I don't know how else to say it. There's not much happening in them. Daryl's quite right. Most of the education programs are being done away with now. Certainly the move in Congress playing to people's worst impulses in this regard has been to take away programs willy-nilly right and left, although it's not always a winner. I noticed the candidate for Senate in New Jersey lost, although he was campaigning in Congress on a platform of making prisons much more harsher in places of punishment.
Dick Zimmer,
yeah.
Republican candidate.
So that, you know, I think it's a commentary on the country and where we're headed. I think it's based in racism. I don't agree with Paul at all that it's been proven that locking people up deters crime dramatically, or that the average offender commits so many hundred offenses during the year. Those were cooked over statistics. They've been misused by these mavens of the right, from James Q. Wilson to John DiIulio, all over the place. These kind of textbook researchers who don't do any research on their own, but kind of cull through others' research to pick and choose and hop and scout, skip, in order to find whatever fits a right-wing agenda. In fact, most people going to prison are not going there for violent crimes. They're not going there for rape and murder and child abduction. The greatest single group now are drug offenses. In fact, most crimes are committed by white people. Most misuse of drugs is by white people. White people tend to use cocaine at a higher rate than black people, but you don't see them going to our prison. You could walk through the D.C. prison system all day and night and never see a white face. You wonder where they all are. The same with the juvenile system. But I don't think this is an issue that's going to be settled by reason. I think it's from the gut, it's throwaway lines, it's sound bites, it's quick fixes, and it's driven by racism.
And they make that division between crack cocaine and cocaine. Cocaine is cocaine. Sometimes, when you think about this crack cocaine, and you think about, well, how does this crack cocaine get into our community? I mean, all of a sudden, why is this stuff manufactured in our community and sold in our community like it's they're passing out sugar?
Well, Paul Kaminor, what about the issue of crack cocaine and the disparity in sentencing for those who've used crack cocaine or selling crack cocaine versus cocaine?
Well, you have to first look at whether you're talking about sentencing under state laws and sentencing under the federal system. There is a disparity under the federal sentencing guidelines between the crack cocaine and the powder cocaine. And the Sentencing Commission attempted to change that. I think that both should be treated equally severe. Rather than lowering the powder cocaine, the crack cocaine punishment to the powder cocaine, we think you should raise the violations for the powder cocaine up to what the crack cocaine is. Crack cocaine is devastating the inner city and the black community, and it's those in that community who want to be drug free, that want the drug pushers out of their neighborhood, who want the dealers out, who want the crack cocaine out, and they want these people in prison. I think it's patronizing to millions of poor minorities who live in these inner cities, who are completely law-abiding. I mean, why aren't they all on crack cocaine? Why aren't they all breaking the law? Because there's something called a free will. There's something called personal responsibility and accountability.
So you don't think the system is broken, really? You think the system is working, that people who break laws are put in jail, and that's good?
That's correct.
Now, clearly, Jerome Miller, you have a very different feeling. Here in this country, I think the figures are that we have more people incarcerated than anywhere in the industrialized world. And I wanted to talk about alternatives, the kind of alternatives that you have been looking at.
Well, there are so many. One could talk about halfway houses. One could talk about educational programs. You could talk about alternative sentencing. There's a whole wide range of things one can do. And in fact, in general, they work better than does the prison setting. But I don't think we're in any mood to talk about such things nationally, precisely because there is now such an overrepresentation of minorities in the prison system. It has undermined community support as well. Well, although Paul says, the black community are the victims of crack cocaine, he's quite right. But the idea that one is going to organize against a, quote, criminal element, end quote, is just nonsense, because everyone has been criminalized. Certainly, 75% or more of the males now have criminal records of some sort. It usually doesn't amount to much, but they've at least been arrested, handcuffed, made to assume the position, given a mugshot, and put on the file. files. We have active in this country now 50 million criminal records that are kept in our computers. The great majority of people of color, men of color, now have such records. And that's undermining to the community. The idea that everyone has a brother or a son or a father or someone in the family that's already been subjected to this process is not a healthy thing for the society, and it's not something around which people are going to organize to so-called get the criminal, because everyone is being criminalized.
You're saying that the climate is not there now for change, but you have been dedicating your life to talk about alternatives to these institutions. So whether or not the climate's there, what are some of your suggestions?
Well, my suggestions would be to use prisons in a very chary sort of manner, that you don't use them as a first resort, and you certainly confine them to people who are convicted of major crimes of violence. We would be doing this if these were primarily white middle-class people. It's fascinating to watch the series on the sentencing guidelines in the Washington Post recently, in which they were criticizing the sentencing guidelines. If you looked at that series, it really is because some of the sentencing guidelines, particularly the harsher ones, are beginning to affect white middle-class people. And at that point, there will be a call for change. But I don't see that happening soon, because I don't think we're going to fill our prisons with white middle-class people. The idea that Paul says that we should make all drug charges heavier, and we should convict and send away white people with powder cocaine at the same rate we do people with crack cocaine, is whistling in the dark. We're never going to do that. Because of the racism that permeates our society.
And if we do, there's going to be one less talk show host in town. Oliver North, I guess, will be behind bars. Daryl King, you wanted to get in there?
Yeah, I wanted to say, what about the school system? I mean, why aren't we doing better in the school system? I mean, if we were really teaching reading and writing, I mean, investing some of that $30,000 instead of putting a person in prison into the school system where they can learn and get competitive power, because that's what we lack. We lack the power to compete. I mean, I had a friend of mine just speak to me the other day, and who was wrongfully arrested and let go. She applied. She never knew that the record still stood, and she applied for a job, and she was denied the job because she had a record. That woman's never been in jail.
Well, that's very common. There have been a couple of economic studies that show a simple arrest with no conviction of any kind sets your job opportunities back very dramatically, particularly with a larger company or firm. And that's now throughout the black community.
And I think most of us, we want to do the right thing, and we're just not afforded the opportunity to do the right thing. And I'll say this too, is when during the Vietnam era, when blacks came out of the service, there was no jobs. There was no jobs for us. What did we do? Go back out into the streets. We started using drugs out of depression. I mean, there's a whole history of information about this, and we don't talk about this.
Daryl, you're much too reasonable for the time.
I wanted to give out phone numbers for the different groups that you all represent. Daryl King, the Community Justice Center in Harlem, which is an advocacy group for ex-convicts and also for those in prison. Can you give us your phone number?
It's 212-427-4545.
That's 212-427-4545. And Jerome Miller, your group here in Washington, D.C., the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives.
Number there is 703-684-0373.
That's 703-684-0373. And the Washington Legal Foundation.
Yes, it's 202-588-0302.
That's 202-588-0302.
Right.
Paul Kaminer, do you believe in prevention? Do you believe in investing in prevention?
Well, he talked about education. I mean, we can have a whole program just on that. I mean, the public education system here in Washington, D.C. is absolutely abysmal. And you talk about competition. We can get into a whole thing about school vouchers and things like that, charter schools. I think that's one way perhaps to solve a part of the problem, but we can do both. You don't have to.
But once you're dealing with this large population in prison, what about prevention to prevent recidivism?
Well, part of prevention is not only incarceration rates that are high, so people know that if they do the crime, they'll do the time. But New York also has this program of community police programs where they have 7,000 more cops on the street, where they're visible out there, so there's an actual deterrent on the street. And you see New York crime rates have gone down. So deterrence works by more police and higher incarceration rates.
Darrell King, we give you the last word, and it can only take 15 seconds.
Deterrent is not more police. It's educational programs and creating jobs in our community.
You can do both.
Well, on that note, we have to say goodbye. We want to thank Jerome Miller. His book is called Search and Destroy, African-American Males and the Criminal Justice System, Paul Kaminar of the Washington Legal Foundation, and Darrell King, who's with the Criminal Justice Center in Harlem, New York. We want to thank you all for being with us. Rather, that's the Community Justice Center in Harlem, New York. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230 for an audio cassette. That's 1-800-735-0230. You've been listening to Democracy Now!, produced by Julie Drizin with help from Dave Rabin, our engineer, Kenneth Mason. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!